Okay, we'll call the meeting to order for the Environment and Natural Resources Committee for February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. Hope we can get you out of here in time to enjoy it. I notice it's a lot like the first day of school here. I went to the wrong committee room, and then I found Chairman Mahoney was in this room, and there were two members of the Commerce Commission sitting down, or Commerce Committee sitting down at the end here. So everybody's still trying to find their way. We're going to be hitting the ground running here. We're taking up a bill right now, clean cars legislation with Representative Horstman. First of all, before we start with the legislation, I'd like approval of the minutes from the last two committees that we had, the last hearing on February 11th, and the very last from last session. Let's see the date on that, May 7th, 2007. Anyone willing to move the minutes from those two committees? Two committee meetings. So, Representative Soylent moves those minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. So, Representative Horstman, if you would like to step forward and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I understand that you have an amendment for your bill.
That's right. And the one I didn't cross or I didn't dot was to find out who would move the bill for me and the amendment in committee. So if Representative Scalzi, I believe you're a co-author or Representative Reinhart.
Yes, I move the amendment.
Representative Scalzi moves the amendment. Oh, I guess, first of all, we need to move the bill.
That's
and then move the amendment, so.
I'll move the bill.
Representative Scalzi moves the bill. And, do we have the amendment for us? Okay. And the amendment is coming around, and yes, would you like to...
Then I'll move the amendment to House File 863.
Okay, Representative Scalzi moves amendment. DE5 amendment.
Okay, DE5.
And now... Okay. Yeah, and I was just informed that the DE4 amendment, which you did have in your packets, I believe, is not the one we're working from. It's going to be the DE5, which is being handed out. And this is a read-all amendment, and Representative Horstman, if you'd like to speak to the amendment, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think what might make sense is to speak to the bill in general, and then, because it's complicated, kind of refer to the amendment after that, because the amendment is... Technical changes really would sort of pertain to the legal situation.
Okay. Maybe what we normally do is just adopt the amendment and then speak to the whole bill. And usually there's not much discussion on the amendment itself.
Okay.
Because you're just putting it in the order that you would like it. So if you just briefly say what the amendment does, then we'll vote on that and then speak to the whole bill.
What the amendment does is it makes clear that we would be adopting the entire California low emission vehicle program. And under federal law, you have two choices. You have California or the federal standard. You don't get to have part of California and part of the federal. So it makes very clear that we're choosing California and that we are not going to adopt the zero emission vehicle portion of the program, which is severable. And then it also makes clear that this law would not be effective in the state of Minnesota until the federal waiver is granted.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Horstman. Again, this is an amendment to get the bill into the form and shape that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Horstman to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for hearing my California Clean Car Standards bill today. I'd like to be very clear at the outset of that this is a bill about emissions from motor vehicles. It's not a fuel efficiency bill. And Congress exclusively regulates fuel efficiency. So what we're talking about is a measure to control air pollution that comes from motor vehicles. And under the Clean Air Act that was enacted in 1970, states were given a choice of whether to follow California's set of regulations or to follow the federal. And the reason there were two sets of regulations is that California was way ahead of the game in terms of regulating emissions from motor vehicles. In Minnesota last year, we adopted very ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals. We adopted the Next Generation Energy Act, working together bipartisanly in the legislature, and the governor signed it. And that act sets nation-leading goals for greenhouse gas reduction. We set a goal for our state to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 15% by 2050, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. When we enacted that legislation, we made a commitment together that we were going to do some very difficult things and some innovative things and some things that would stretch us technologically to meet these very aggressive goals. Now, I think as a state, it doesn't make any sense for us to start enacting policies that only address greenhouse gas emissions, because some of these things will be very difficult for us to do. But I think what we should do is adopt policies that we'll have no regrets about. If it's too late for us to change what's happening with greenhouse gases, if there's no such thing as man-made greenhouse gas warming, then these are policies we could adopt because they're good for Minnesota anyway. The California Clean Car Standard meets that. It would further public health by reducing pollutants from motor vehicles. It would also decrease our dependence on foreign oil by driving technological development in the auto manufacturing industry to make more fuel-efficient vehicles. It would promote the use of ethanol nationwide, since E85 is a much less carbon-intensive fuel than gasoline. And it would save consumers money. When the California Air Resources Board did an analysis on the cost to consumers of enacting the greenhouse gas regulations, they found that consumers would actually save money. Even though the automakers and the California Air Resources Board estimate there could be an increased cost in purchasing of a new car, the amount of money that a consumer will save over the lifetime of the car will more than make up for that. Now, I think it's important to look at the impact that this law would have on our state in terms of our greenhouse gas reduction goals as well. The California Clean Car Standard would decrease carbon dioxide equivalent emissions by 13.1 million metric tons by 2025, by a conservative estimate. Some of you may be aware that the governor appointed a number of stakeholders to a group called the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and that this group worked all summer and all fall and into the winter to come up with strategies and actions that we could take as a state to reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals. In that process, a lot of data analysis was done pertaining to cost of reducing emissions and to how much we could reduce our emissions by taking certain actions. And in doing that analysis, that group determined that taking this action was recommended and that it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions 13.1 million metric tons by 2025. Now, there will be a lot of discussion about the legal issues, because ever since the California greenhouse gas emission standards were adopted, there has been a lot of litigation about them. The most significant litigation was a case at the Supreme Court last year that sought to determine whether carbon dioxide was an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act and whether states could regulate it at all. And that decision was decided on April 2nd, 2007, that carbon dioxide is an air pollutant and that states may regulate it. Many of you also have heard of the federal corporate average fuel economy standards were increased, the CAFE standards. In December, Congress finally passed and Bush finally signed a bill to increase fuel efficiency in cars. As I said at the beginning, that's a separate matter. Air pollution and fuel efficiency are separate matters. These two laws do not interfere with each other, and that has been litigated up to the highest levels of court, and the courts have found that the California Clean Car Standards are not a fuel economy standard, and they don't conflict with the federal standards. The federal standard is a gigantic step forward. But I'll tell you, I remember working in Washington, D.C., 1991 and 1992. I wrote letters to constituents for Senator John Kerry. And I wrote to hundreds and hundreds of constituents how Senator Kerry supported changing the CAFE standards in 1991. Why did it take until December 2007 to change the CAFE standards? I believe that it was pressure from the state. It was this innovation of California and many states all over the country joining in that created the pressure on the automakers and on the Bush administration to finally act. So I think it's very important for the states to continue to innovate and continue to push. I really liked what Governor Pawlenty had to say in September. He said, when a number of states take a bold action on greenhouse gas policy, it becomes a de facto national policy. And that's what Minnesota would be doing by adopting the California Clean Car Standards. We would be saying to Congress, don't move backwards, continue to move forward, continue to adopt these things. And then finally, I just would like to talk briefly about the EPA waiver denial, because I think it was probably 9 days after the Federal Energy Act was signed that the EPA denied a waiver for California to implement its latest portion of the California Clean Car Standards. California has required a waiver from the EPA to implement every element of its program over the years, and the EPA has granted 40 such waivers in the last 35 years. This is the first one to be denied. EPA staff has leaked memos that indicate there's no legal or factual basis for EPA to have denied this waiver. Of all the legal challenges that the Clean Car Standard has faced, the EPA's denial of a waiver is the slenderest and is the most likely to be resolved quickly. There was a debate of the Republican presidential candidates on January 30th, 2008, and the CNN moderator asked each of the presidential candidates, do they think that the Bush administration should grant Governor Schwarzenegger a waiver so that he could implement the California Clean Car Standards? And all of the presidential candidates still in the race on the Republican side of the aisle said they would issue the waiver. So the waiver will be issued in January of 2009, if not sooner. And we can put this law into effect. So Minnesota should act now. It gives auto manufacturers time to respond to the directive. And we should continue to be a nation leader. When some of us this summer spent time with other legislators from other parts of the country, they were very impressed at what a leadership role Minnesota has taken in so many areas of environmental law, and particularly our greenhouse gas reduction goals. Taking this step and joining the 12 other states that have already done it will keep Minnesota one of the leaders of the pack. Mr. Chair, Jim Urkel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy also has a lot of information about the bill.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Urkel, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I also served on the Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group for the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, although I wasn't a member of the advisory group itself. One of the recommendations from the Technical Working Group that was adopted by the advisory group was that Minnesota should move forward and adopt the California Clean Car Standards. I'll try and explain what the standards are, how they were adopted, and hit on some of the points of disagreement that were raised in both the discussions by the working group as well as the advisory group. I'll also try and put the recommendation into context by explaining how other states are taking action in regards to California Clean Car Standards and the effect of the new CAFE standard. I'd like to start, though, with a quick reminder of what climate change means to Minnesota. In the last century, Minnesota's average annual temperature has increased by 0.79 degrees Fahrenheit, almost twice its long-term natural range of variability. Although slightly less than the global average increase of 1 degree Fahrenheit, there are several locations in Minnesota that have experienced temperature increases of 2 to 3 degrees. For example, the average annual temperature at Fort Snelling increased 2.9 degrees between the 1860s and 1987, almost three times the global increase. Researchers from the University of Minnesota have noted that the average annual temperature difference between the coniferous forest in Itasca State Park and the prairies in Manoman County is only about 5 degrees. In light of its estimated increase in temperature between 2 and 10 degrees based on global warming, Minnesota may experience the kind of quick shift of ecosystems and natural communities suggested by that difference, with some possibly drastic problems for Minnesota's farm and forest-based economies. We can already see some of that transition in the boundary waters following the July 4th, 1999 blowdown. Again, university researchers are concerned that the forest communities that are coming back after the blowdown reflect more of the central hardwoods of the eastern United States than the forests of the north. For some time, California has been concerned about similar effects of climate change on its economy and ecosystems. Specifically, California acknowledged that climate change has the potential to reduce snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas, which supplies water throughout the state, adversely affecting agriculture production because of the lack of water and the increase in pestilence outbreaks. There'd be a doubling of catastrophic fires and flooding of its coastline and damage to its marine ecosystem. California also knows that passenger cars and light-duty trucks are responsible for about 40% of its greenhouse gas emissions. As a result, California passed Assembly Bill 1493 in 2002, which requires the California Air Resources Board to adopt regulations to reduce transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions. The board was directed to adopt regulations that would achieve the maximum feasible and cost-efficient effective reduction of greenhouse gas emissions for motor vehicles. The legislation defined maximum feasible and cost-effective reductions as meaning those actions capable of being successfully accomplished within the time provided, taking into account environmental, economic, social, and technological factors and that are economical to an owner-operator of a vehicle, taking into account the full life cycle cost of the vehicle. In developing the regulations, the board was directed to consider technological feasibility, the effect on businesses, including auto workers and auto manufacturing facilities in the state, the state's ability to maintain and attract business, provide flexibility in the means by which the regulations could be met, grant credits for steps taken by manufacturers to reduce greenhouse gas emissions prior to the date the regulations took effect. Importantly, the board could not require any mandatory trip reduction measures or land use restrictions, impose additional fees or taxes on vehicles, fuels, or vehicle miles traveled, or ban any category of vehicle or consider any reduction in vehicle weight. In addition to the economic and technical reviews, the legislation required the board to hold public hearings throughout the state, including communities at greatest risk from the public health effects of transportation-related air pollution, and submit the regulations to the legislature for review before they could take effect. This broad and substantial mandate belies the claims by manufacturers that the board is somehow politically unaccountable, is working unchecked, and would run and has run amok with the standards. To set the emission standards, the board worked with automotive engineering experts to model reductions for five vehicle types: small and larger cars, small and large trucks and SUVs, and minivans. They also worked with various technological packages, such as engine, drivetrain, and air conditioning systems. The emission standards for each category of vehicle were then set based on the manufacturer with the heaviest weight vehicles in order to satisfy the legislative prohibition on considering any reduction in vehicle weight. As part of its work, the board performed a detailed evaluation of the technologies available to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the reductions that could be achieved, and the cost of achieving them. In the near term, the evaluation identified a number of technologies that were already in the market, such as cylinder deactivation, improved transmission, variable valve timing and lift, turbocharging, direct injection of gasoline, and more efficient low-leak air conditioning systems. For the near term, the evaluation identified technologies that the board felt would be widely available, including integrated starter generators, camless valve actuation, gasoline homogeneous combustion compression ignition engines, and more efficient low-leak air conditioning systems using alternative refrigerants. The standards that the board set phase in between model years 2009 and model year 2016. The standards reduce carbon dioxide equivalent emissions for passenger cars small trucks and SUVs from 320 grams per mile in model year 2009 to 205 grams per mile in model year 2016. For large trucks and SUVs, the reduction is from 439 grams per mile in model year 2009 to 332 in model year 2016. As a result, large trucks and SUVs get to end at emission levels higher than passenger cars actually start at. Ford found that the standards will result in an 18% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the light-duty vehicle fleet in 2020 and a 27% reduction in 2030. Importantly, the board also found that the standards would reduce criteria air pollution as well. In addition to the phase-in period and separate standards by vehicle class, the board also included a number of measures to allow maximum flexibility for manufacturers. The standards take into account and fully credit the differences in greenhouse gas emissions from alternative fuels, including the differences in upstream emissions. It allows manufacturers to average emissions across their models, aggregate the different greenhouse gas pollutants, bank excess credits for subsequent use, and trade credits with other manufacturers. The standards also provide credit for emission reductions achieved between model year 2000 and model year 2008. So anything that they do before the standards take effect in model year 2009, they are credited for. The standard also includes a credit for improvements in air conditioning systems and a specific exemption for a portion of a manufacturer's fleet to account for work trucks. Similar to what you'll hear later, manufacturers claimed then that the standard would restrict model availability because they wouldn't be able to sell large trucks and SUVs and still meet the vehicle's fleet average. However, the standard was set by the board such that it could be met by all manufacturers while maintaining full availability of all models. This argument has been raised by manufacturers since the start of vehicle-based air pollution standards, but the number of models that are available today is many more available today than there were in the 70s when those air pollution restrictions or emission regulations were first adopted. Manufacturers also argued that the standards would restrict vehicle attributes such as acceleration, weight, and towing capacity. Modeling performed by the board assumed that while meeting the standards, vehicles would also maintain the projected model year 2009 performance levels. In fact, the board set up its evaluation specifically to avoid downsizing in order to satisfy its legislative mandate. Manufacturers argued that the standards make it highly unlikely for them to meet the standards with vehicles that burn E85. There may be practical difficulties for using E85, particularly in California, but it was revealed in litigation last year that GM has certified flexible fuel vehicles in California. Manufacturers also argue that the credit for use of E85 is impractical because it requires them to show that E85 vehicles are actually burning E85. In the same litigation, though, GM confirmed that it has an onboard diagnostic device which measures the amount of fuel passing through the system and the number of miles the vehicle travels and sends the operator a monthly email with information regarding the vehicle's fuel economy. The court found that there's no reason why it would not be possible for such technology to monitor and report alcohol content of the fuel as well. It was based on this kind of proof that the court dismissed the manufacturer's arguments in that case as unconvincing, improbable, highly unlikely, and not credible. As part of its economic review, the board estimated that the incremental cost of control in the near term to meet the standards was $367 for passenger cars, small trucks, and SUVs, and $277 for large trucks and SUVs. In the midterm, the cost of control would be $1,064 for passenger cars, small trucks, and SUVs, and $1,029 for large trucks and SUVs. However, the board found that the upfront costs would be more than offset by savings in operating costs. For example, the board found that in model year 2016, and at a gas price of $1.74 a gallon, the increased vehicle payments for a typical five-year lease, less the reduction in operating costs, would result in monthly savings of between $3.50 and $7. And in fact, basically they would cover the cost of control within about a year and a half. At higher fuel prices, the monthly savings would increase and the payout would be less than a year. Manufacturers argued that the board had underestimated the cost of control and stated that the cost would be more than $3,000 per vehicle in the midterm. However, the board relied on a state-of-the-art evaluation of the technologies for greenhouse gas emission reduction. In addition, the board heard evidence that manufacturers have historically overestimated cost of control by a factor of 2 to 10 times actual cost. In fact, a study of the board's technology forcing regulations showed that the actual cost of control imposed by its regulations have been lower by about half than its original estimates. Moreover, studies show that the cost of control represent only about a third of the increase in vehicle prices over the same period and are often swamped by the year-to-year variability in the market. Following the required review, the board adopted the greenhouse gas standards as part of its low-emission vehicle 2 or LEV 2 regulations. Under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act, California may adopt those standards they can adopt standards that are stricter than the U.S. EPA standards as long as they're given a waiver, and the waiver requires certain findings on the part of California, including that the emissions are at least as strict as the EPA regulations. This exception to the preemption effect of the Clean Air Act on state action dealing with vehicle-based air emissions acknowledges that California has been working on transportation-based air pollution since prior to the Act, and that it serves as a laboratory for standards that are often subsequently adopted at the national level. In fact, when California is granted a waiver by EPA from its Act preemption, the standards actually stand as federal regulations, and that was one of the findings in another case that was litigated in California last year as well. Adopting states, under Section 177 of the Clean Air Act, other states can adopt California standards for which waivers have been issued by EPA. Adopting states need not adopt all of California standards, but whatever they adopt must be identical to what California has established. EPA has held that adopting states need not adopt portions of the standards which are considered segregable. EPA has held that fuel standards and the zero-emission vehicle portion of California's LEV fuel regulations need not be adopted by adopting states. Following California's adoption of its greenhouse gas standards, a number of states began taking steps to adopt them as well. At the moment, 12 states have already adopted them, and they're waiting on the waiver request that was denied by EPA and is now being challenged by California, and many of those states have joined California's challenge to the denial by EPA. The Transportation Land Use Technical Working Group recommended, and the Climate Change Advisory Group adopted a position that Minnesota should join these states and other states that are considering the possibility of adopting California clean car standards. Manufacturers have argued that the standards are not appropriate given Minnesota's conditions. However, a quick study of other states shows that Minnesota's exceptionalism is not sufficient as an excuse to not move forward with MCAG's recommendations. If staff hasn't already done it, I'd like them to pass out the chart that I prepared, which lists the 21 states that have either, 20 states plus California that have either adopted California standards or in the process of adopting them or are considering them. And I don't know if you have it. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. If you take a look at it, it's pretty interesting. 12 states have adopted the standards already, and they're waiting in the queue for a waiver from EPA. Two are in process. That includes Arizona and Florida. Two are waiting to kick off that process, including Colorado, which is waiting on an executive order from their governor. And then there are four that have recommendations from climate change entities similar to Minnesota's Climate Change Advisory Group. And you can see when they were adopted, I have added some political information that shows that this is a bipartisan movement. There are red governors in blue states that have moved forward with these. There are blue governors and red tapes. There's red on red and blue on blue. You can see also the number of cars that are. These are the latest numbers that I was able to come up with dealing with new vehicle registration. So you can see that a number of these states register many more vehicles than we do. Others register less. I also, because one of the arguments from the manufacturers is that these standards won't do well with Minnesota's fleet. I have included a fleet mix for all of the states, and you can see that 8 of them have a smaller proportion of cars than Minnesota does. There are a number that have way more trucks than even we do. And then when you look, one of the other arguments is that these will have an adverse impact on our agriculture and forest products industry. So the last column deals with the state gross domestic product coming from agriculture and forestry, and you can see that a number of states have substantially more or larger ag and forest industries than we have, and even on the ones that show up as smaller than ours in total, a number of them as a percent of total state GNP rank much higher, and so there are a number of them that are like that. I would particularly point out Florida. If they red governor with a red state issued an executive order to move forward with the regulations. That's happening right now. And as you can see, their fleet mix is pretty much right on spot with Minnesota's, and their ag and forestry products industries are even larger than ours, which suggests that, and I would assume that they've also considered the effect on the use of trucks in those industries, and are satisfied that it will not adversely affect those industries. One of the things to keep in mind is that the definition of trucks in this list, which comes from the National Highway Statistics Annual Yearbook, is based on the definition of vehicles that comes from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which administers the CAFE standards. And for those purposes, on that side of the numbers, PT cruisers show up as trucks, even though they can't haul much of anything at all. And I've been around Minnesota a little bit, but I've never seen one driving around on a farm. The last point I'd like to make deals with the CAFE standards that were recently adopted in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2004. Those ramp up the fuel economy for passenger cars from today's 20.7 miles per gallon to 35 miles per gallon in 2020. The California Air Resources Board did an assessment after the denial of the waiver by EPA that looked at tried to compare the new CAFE standards with the clean car standards that they had adopted. And what they found was that because the California standards ramp up earlier, even assuming that the new CAFE standards would ramp up in an even way, that it still represents a huge savings in as Representative Portman suggested, in a no regrets kind of way, of very large carbon savings. And the difference by 2016 represented on the order of like 15 to 18% better emission reductions than you would get under the new CAFE standards. They then extended that study out to 2020. The problem is that as part of that assessment, they assumed a second round of clean car standards, and the manufacturers claim that that's not credible because it's completely speculative, but it's very much more than that. Under California's Assembly Bill 32, California's Global Warming Solutions Act, the Air Resources Board must identify actions that can be taken to reduce global emissions by certain amounts by 2020. They must identify certain early action steps they can take. as part of that process, they've identified a number of those. Those are in draft form right now. But one of the things that they also came up with and have committed to is a moving the California Clean Car Standards from basically a 30% reduction to by 2016 to a 50% reduction in 2020. That's more than speculative. It's about the only way that California is going to get to its standards in 2020. And so if you include those, you see that by 2020, there is a substantial improvement over what the CAFE standards would apply. And with that.
One note about the information that was passed out. I passed out an information on the cost savings for consumers. Also a copy of an advertisement for a Chevy Tahoe hybrid that meets the standards that would apply in 2016 today. There's also some other examples of cars that are on the market today that meet the standards. So I just want to respond very briefly to the National Ethanol Vehicle Coalition letter because I don't think that they're here. But the reason that they state in their letter that Minnesotans should be concerned, they say, is that the California zero emission vehicle standards would preclude the sale of E85 vehicles. We're not adopting the zero emission vehicle standards in California. So if that is the sole basis of their objection, we don't have that problem. In fact, if you're a fan of ethanol, I think this is one of the best things that we can do in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. That's an important point. And I'd like to open it up if anybody has questions for Mr. Urkel or Representative Hortman at this point. Okay, seeing no questions, why don't we move on to the next testifier we have on the agenda here. Yes, Ms. Molly Schultz from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Schultz. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are a coalition of 80 conservation and environmental organizations throughout the state. We represent nearly 500,000 Minnesotans who believe that the protection of our lakes, our land, and our air is just really the core of protecting our future. And each year, our members choose a few issues that we believe rise to the level of having the full force of the coalition behind their passage. And we call it our collaborative or our priority agenda. And our members have some criteria in mind when selecting an issue, and those are the impact it will have on the great outdoors, whether or not there's broad public support, and also the timing, whether or not we feel like we're in sort of that sweet spot where the state just feels like it's ripe and time for this to be successful and pass. And the Clean Car Standards really met all of these criteria. I know that Jim and Melissa talked a lot about the importance, and so I wanted to focus a little bit on the broad public support. MEP conducted focus groups and polling throughout the state this fall, and we found that the adoption of these standards is, quite frankly, a no-brainer to most Minnesotans. We kept hearing over and over again in our focus groups that people thought we really should have done this a long time ago. Over 80% of Minnesotans believe that these regulations are an important step towards reducing global warming pollution and that they are necessary to increase pressure on manufacturers to produce more efficient cars. And this support cut across party lines, it cut across demographics such as age and gender, and it was also similar throughout the region geographically throughout the state. The focus groups we conducted were of residents in western suburbs that included Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska, and residents of the Austin-Albert Lea area. And these were ordinary people. They were selected by an independent firm. They were not our members. They were not self-selected as environmentalists or conservationists. And again, we found strong support across the same demographic and party lines. And Minnesotans across the state want to drive cars that pollute less and use less gas. And they know that that's good for the air we breathe. They know it's good for our great outdoors. And they know that it helps us take a real step towards energy independence. The other thing we found in our polling is that Minnesotans know that automakers have dragged their heels when it comes to producing cars that don't emit as much global warming pollution. The technologies exist, as Jim and Representative Portman explained, Automakers are not moving fast enough, according to what we found through our members and through our polling. Over and over, we heard members of our focus group say they aren't going to do it on their own, and we really do have to make them do it. Jim and Representative Cortman did talk a little bit about how this crossed party lines nationally, and so we really felt like this was a good time for this bill to pass in Minnesota. And so it is a little puzzling to the Minnesota Environmental Partnership and our member group when we look at where we're at today, and we're facing a lot of the same arguments that have been tried and failed in 13 other states. I was at a meeting the other night and talking about our initiatives, and someone said to me, there's a website. It's called DontTakeMyTruck.com, and you have to go to it. It tells you that this bill is going to make it impossible to get trucks and minivans. And I got home, and I thought, geez, I better check that out. And I did. I went to the website, and I found out that there's a lot of language in here saying that our members are considered environmental extremists, that we are urging Minnesotans to follow California's extremists. And I actually wanted to call them and talk to them talk to them about why our members were supporting this, but there wasn't a name or a phone number. So I did do a domain name search, and I found out that it was registered to the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. And so it's a little discouraging for us to see that kind of language out there. And I guess I just want to say that if driving cars that pollute less is considered extremist by the auto dealers, there's not much I can say about that. But it does seem like every time this bill is introduced in a state, manufacturers hire marketing firms and lobbyists to defeat it. When that doesn't work and the bill's passed, they hire lawyers to sue. And that hasn't worked for them either. And I'm here today because Minnesotans know that it's time to sift through all of the disproven facts, the history of inflated cost estimates, the failed legal challenges. They know that it's time to stop fighting progress and start paying engineers and mechanics who will develop and build these technologies. Global warming pollution from our cars won't go away if we just ignore it. If we give the auto industry a free pass today, we're going to have to ask other sectors of the economy to cut even deeper into their own reductions. We urge you to pass this bill and move Minnesota closer to a real and comprehensive global warming solution. And I thank you for your time.
Chairman.
And, thank you, Ms. Schultz. Representative Cornish, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, ma'am, give me an example of a few of those questions that you sent out for your polling. I mean, did they say the fish are going to die and we're going to choke to death on carbon if we don't enact it, or how are they worded? What kind of questions did you ask? Because you can get somebody to answer the poll any way you want to. I'd like an example of.
You know, Representative Cornish, members of the committee, that's a very good question. And you're right. Poll questions can be phrased any way they want. And there's quite a bit of push polling done. I can tell you that we did hire an independent company to feel like we could word our questions very fairly. I did not bring examples of them today, and I don't want to quote them. I can certainly provide you with copies of those questions. I would like you to take a look through them and see that we really have done the best we could to get objective answers. I think that it doesn't benefit us to have a poll that skews results one way based on inflammatory language. So we really did try our best to be objective.
Thank you.
Representative Dell has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Did you say something about focus groups in your testimony? And where were those focus groups? Where did you do that?
Representative Bill, members of the committee, yes, I did talk about focus groups. The Minnesota Environmental Partnership conducted 4 separate focus groups. We did 2. They were held in Edina at a marketing firm, a marketing firm in Edina. They were comprised of residents from Eden Prairie, Chaska, and Chanhassen. We did 2 groups. We did a group of women and then a group of men. Our focus group coordinator believes that having the gender separate would be more encouraging for the discussion. Apparently, women tend to dominate discussions, so they wanted to separate the genders. And we then did We then did two focus groups down in Albert Lea, and those were made up of residents of the Austin and Albert Lea area. Again, they were divided by gender. The one thing that our focus group coordinator did is she separated out. We did not bring in anyone who had self-selected as an extremely liberal Democrat or an extremely liberal extremely conservative Republican or extremely liberal Democrat. We tried to focus on the folks that were independent and leaned one way or the other, but not real diehard one way or the other.
Yeah, Representative Dale.
So when you cited those focus groups, I assume people attended the meetings and weren't done by phone or anything like that. Why wouldn't you do something where, like in the northern part of the state, like where, you know, people live, like that participate in mining and logging and agriculture, mm-hmm. although the Albert Lea one certainly would have something to do with agriculture. Agriculture is a bit different in the northern part of the state, let's say in Representative Olin's district. And certainly transportation needs are different, mm-hmm. you know, in the northeast where they're mining and logging and people who go to the Boundary Waters, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their transportation needs, they have a canoe. I'm not sure, I think they are the ones that put out the greenhouse gases while they're paddling. But nonetheless, that's my question.
Michelle.
I'm not sure where which end it comes out of, but.
Representative Bill, members of the committee, I'm not sure about emissions from canoes. I'll have to look into that for you. We chose those two areas. I think that we wanted to get a sense of where some of the suburbanites, some of the western suburbanites were feeling about these issues. I do agree with you that we need to conduct focus groups in other regions of the state. A couple of years ago, we did one up in St. Cloud, which is not considered outstate or greater Minnesota anymore. I would like to come up to your neck of the woods and conduct a focus group, and when we do, I would invite you to come and watch your neighbors talk about these issues. I'd be very interested in seeing that.
But one last question.
Sure.
I'm not trying to be hard to get along with here. I'm just wondering, were the results from the suburban people different than the people in Albert Lea?
Representative Dill and members of the committee, we didn't see that much difference. We did. The interesting thing that we saw about the folks down in the Austin Albert Lea area, when we talked to them about clean cars and we talked to them about transit, they very much had a belief that that air quality problems were coming to their neck of the woods pretty quickly. They believed that in the past it had been something that was reserved, poor air days were reserved for the metro area, but they are starting to see those types of problems down there. No, we did not see a significant difference, and I'd be more than happy to stop by and share with you the results of our focus groups and any one of the committee members who wants to see them. They were pretty interesting.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Schultz. And we have Ms. Carla Heil, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correct, from the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. If you could state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Carla Heil, H-E-Y-L, Assistant Attorney General, and I'm with the Attorney General's Environmental Protection Division. The reason I wanted to talk today, actually Representative Portman asked, was to just clarify why the Attorney General, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, intervened in the lawsuit involving the California waiver with the greenhouse gas. And just a little background, under the Clean Air Act, generally states can be more strict, more protective, generally. However, for motor vehicle emissions, there the EPA has preempted states, except for California, that California can pass motor vehicle emissions. And Representative Portman did mention that. And if California adopts motor vehicle emissions, then other states can also adopt the California standards. So there's either the federal standards or the California standards. And generally, why did this become an issue? It is probably the greenhouse gas issue, but there have been 12 states that have adopted the California vehicle emissions. And with the lawsuit that Minnesota intervened in December of 2007, the EPA denied California's request to have a stricter greenhouse or a greenhouse gas standard for motor vehicle emissions. And that was the first denial of California's waiver request in 40 years, and they had already approved 50, and so this was the first one. There the EPA said there are no compelling or extraordinary reasons to allow California to regulate greenhouse gas motor vehicle emissions. And Minnesota, along with presently there are now 19 states involved in that lawsuit challenging California's denial or EPA's denial of California's waiver request. The reason Minnesota intervened in that lawsuit is basically to preserve this state's rights if the state of Minnesota wants to adopt the California vehicle emission standard. And even though the impetus was, you know, the greenhouse gas, the state of Minnesota already has on its books the ability to adopt the California standards if they want to, that the state could adopt the rest of the California package. But that's a policy question, and that's, I think, what Representative Portman's bill is looking at. And more importantly, it's the greenhouse gas challenge. The reason that it came to the front was Minnesota's, as we stated in our petition, the ambitious nature of the Next Generation Energy Act of trying to cut greenhouse gas. And California has an ambitious, stricter standards in the federal. If Minnesota adopted the California standards, it would also be able to adopt the greenhouse gas one. And I think Representative Portman made clear with the California standards, it's the class of vehicles that the state of Minnesota adopts. That it isn't just a greenhouse gas or a nitrous oxide. Instead, it's passenger vehicles or light-duty vehicles. And that is what Representative Portman's bill covers. For the California case, just briefly, with it's going to be fully briefed by April of 2007. So it's on a very fast track. And Minnesota would get the benefit of a favorable result if the EPA's decision is overturned. And then Minnesota could adopt the final one that California just did, the greenhouse gas. But the legislation before you is broader than that. It's the whole California Vehicle Commission.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hale. Any questions? Representative Dale.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure, Ms. Hale, if you're the right person to ask this. Seemed to be that you would. The bill as drafted right now doesn't include any thing other than motor vehicles and light-duty vehicles, as I understand it. It doesn't include ATVs. It couldn't include ATVs, snowmobiles, four-wheelers, any off-road vehicles.
Representative Deal, Mr. Chair, quite frankly, I have not looked at the specific provision of California. You'll have to ask Representative Portman specifically.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, looking at this delete all amendment, or what is now essentially the bill, it doesn't tell us a lot about what the California standards are and what the regulations are. So with that, I'm asking you, if we do pass this and this becomes law, and this California Commission or whatever it is, changes something or make it more restrictive, does the legislature in Minnesota have a chance to say no to what those changes might be, according to this piece of legislation?
Mr. Hackbarth, Chair, my understanding is that the way this is drafted, the attempt is that you would incorporate by reference what is presently on California's code and what they will adopt also in the future. So the answer to your question is you would not be able to reject California. And in fact, that's part of the whole issue with the EPA. They only want, two vehicles. These are the federal vehicle standards or the California vehicle standards, that they don't want states to just take bits and pieces generally of the California, creating a third vehicle.
So, Mr. Chairman.
That's never had a question.
Thank you. So, I'm to understand, even if this were something that the state of Minnesota could deal with at this point, which I don't think it is, personally, but even if we could deal with it the way it is, this panel in California passes something that maybe California can deal with, we have to adopt that here in Minnesota too, and then we can't do anything about it. We have to comply, and it might be something that we can't do anything about to comply in the state of Minnesota. If you follow my drift, I mean, that doesn't make sense to me that we turn this authority over to this panel and we give away legislative authority to this group of people in California that we don't know or don't have any idea how they feel on different issues. They don't have any idea what we're dealing with in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, I just don't see that this is the right path to take with this piece of legislation, to give that kind of authority away to 5 or 6 or 12 or however many people it is in the state of California. The state of California is going to be running our government in the state of Minnesota, and that's not right.
Representative Portman, did you want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the federal law, we have two choices. We let the crazy people in Congress and the EPA in Washington, D.C. tell us how we're going
to
do it.
You elected the people.
Or the crazy people in California. No, quite seriously, we have two choices. We go with the whole EPA package, or we go with the whole California package. And in the last few years, Governor Schwarzenegger has been leading a tremendous positive change in California. They are doing great work. We see here in Minnesota, when we try to do things on the state level, we can really get things done. If we have to wait for the national leadership and the consensus at the national level, we'll be waiting an awfully long time to adopt standards that we really need in Minnesota here today.
And Representative Hatch,
Mr. Chairman, she didn't address the issue that we're talking about here, though. We're talking about an 11-member panel, or is that what it is, an 11-member panel in California that's going to be regulating the state of Minnesota? That's what I'm talking about, Representative Portman. That's not the way to operate in our state. I don't think our legislature wants to give away that kind of authority.
Well, Representative Hackworth, for one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there is some flexibility in how these standards are applied in the various states. It's not going to be lockstep with the state of California, and there's always the option of opting out if we did have any difficulty in complying with California standards. But I don't know, Representative Horstman or Ms. Heil, if you had any response that you wanted to give.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. The Minnesota legislature could decide that it wanted to go with the EPA model instead. Could opt out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then we should adopt it now. I mean, let's make it cut and dry. We're done. Let's say no to this, and we're done with it. It's a lot harder once you put something into legislation to come back and try to change it. We all know that.
Mr. Chair, I take it that means Representative Hackworth is not going to be voting.
You're right about that.
And Representative Bell had a question.
Okay, thank you. And to either one of you, so if we then have to adopt, or we automatically assume the California decisions, and they decide to implement rules or, you know, rules that include ATVs or off-road vehicles, or for that matter, aircraft, commercial airline or general aviation aircraft, then are we required to then bring them into the fold as well?
Representative Horstman.
Under this legislation.
Ms. Heil.
We can adapt the classes. And I believe that airplanes would be different classes than passenger vehicles. I'm more familiar with the passenger vehicles, light-duty vehicles, medium-duty vehicles. So it's the class that you adopt.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Powell. And
I don't quite understand yet. I'm sorry.
No, to be very clear, we are not adopting any emissions standards related to snowmobiles or ATVs. That is not at all what the California motor vehicle emission standards are about or touch.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, my question is if California decides to incorporate into their motor vehicle or into their vehicle regulations aircraft or ATVs or off-road vehicles, then by virtue of this legislation, do then we have to then take that same ruling?
I guess that it would be a different classification, but you want to respond, Representative Horton?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill. The Horton, I believe on the DE5 amendment, it's page 2 at the top of the page, about the first 12 lines or so. We're referring specifically to the passenger motor vehicle standard. So that would be a different classification of vehicle. That we're not adopting any other classification.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Moe had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You essentially answered it, but I think it's important to reiterate to Representative Hackbar's point about we're making people in California make decisions for us. Again, there are two sets of rules. As Representative Portman said, we can, as a legislature, decide in a future session to adopt the EPA rules as opposed to the California set of rules. So anytime we're in session, we can do that, correct? So we're not locked into this and do that. Okay.
Thank you. And Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize that I've now become confused. If you would look on page 2, on line 2.4, you have an exception there. It says, must not include zero-emission vehicle standards contained in California code regulations. How is that fit with the testimony that you've just provided? I'm confused as to how that's consistent.
Representative Horton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, to every rule there is an exception. And this is the exception, the zero-emission vehicle standard. Maryland, when they opted to go into the California standard, opted not to take the zero-emission vehicle standard, and that was litigated. And people made exactly that argument and said, hey, wait a minute, this is part of your emissions program, and so you have to take it. And the court concluded, no, that this was a separate matter.
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair and Representative Horton, if there are other issues that would come up in the future that Minnesota would take exception to, there is precedent showing that there can be exceptions to the California standard.
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, yes, there's one other area, and that is with regard to warranties and repairs, and there's something that Oregon has done differently to allow automotive service providers some clarity in the law, and it's a slight difference from what California adopted, but they did it in California to protect the automotive service industry there from any ill consequences, and we are intending to do that same thing here in the Commerce Committee.
And Representative Hartman, I also had, as far as who makes the determination as to what the exemptions are, is that done by the board in California, or is that are those exemptions made by the federal government, or are they the ones that determine what the classifications are and what the exemptions are?
It's the California Air Resources Board that determines what the classifications for the different passenger vehicles are and which category a different vehicle would fall into. One thing that's really important to understand about the California Clean Car Standard is it's a fleet-wide average. And so what it's not requiring is a specific type of adjustment to be made to anybody's vehicles that you own today. Whatever you own now, this doesn't require you as a consumer to do anything differently. What it affects is dealers and the cars that they offer for sale in the state of Minnesota, so that the average emissions of all those cars meet a lower standard for emitting carbon dioxide. And so determining how much credit a car gets for carbon dioxide emissions, that is a determination made by the California Air Resources Board.
Thank you. And Representative Olin.
Thank you, Chairman Deacon. Representative Hartman. Representative Dill has now got me very much concerned. Because considering I have 2,900 employees sitting with Arctic and Polaris, I have not got an answer that I can see from California law, because it's not in front of me, as to exactly what is a motor vehicle in California's definition.
And Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Representative Olin and Representative Dill's question, you know, it might not include those now, but this 11-member panel could certainly say in the future that those are considered passenger vehicles, and then they would fall into this. But to my original question that I wanted to ask Representative Portman, currently, does this California emission standard require testing at testing stations?
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, there is no testing at testing stations required.
Mr. Chairman, that doesn't take place in California now?
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I'm not sure if it does or not, but it would not require that in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Dill.
Well, Representative Portman, I read page 2.1, and I'm not an attorney like you, and I still don't understand. If, and so my question, I'm going to try and refine it a little bit. If the California 11-member board or the state of California, the legislature, decided to incorporate into the definition of motor vehicle, ATVs or off-road vehicles or aircraft, then would the state of Minnesota be obliged, or under this law, under this proposed legislation, have to adopt their definition of motor vehicle if it were amended to include those categories?
That's very important.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, my understanding is that the definition of motor vehicle is a matter of federal law. It's in the Code of Federal Regulations. I don't know how much of the Code of Federal Regulations we want to talk about, but...
well, then my question is, Ms. Chairman, if it is Code of Federal Regulations and the Congress decided to do that, then we would automatically be required to adopt that? Or under this legislation, would we be acquiescing and adopting that? I'm trying to get my arms around that, because I've seen the nose of the tent under the camel once before in my life. And so I'm kind of worrying about which end of the camel I'm looking at. The one where the good stuff goes in, or the one where the bad stuff comes out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, if Congress were to determine that it wanted to regulate emissions from snowmobiles, etc., and change the definition of motor vehicle under federal law, Minnesota would be, once again, we'd have the same choice as Representative Moe discussed. We can do either California or federal. So if the federal government decides to change that definition, Minnesota's stuck either way. But I think it's important to be very clear that these standards have been enacted and pertain to passenger vehicles, and no one, to my knowledge, in any place has made the argument that they should be extended or expanded to include off-road vehicles of the nature you're talking about. Representative Hackbarth's aware of the fact that my prom pictures we took on an ATV. We've got a lot of ATVs in this family, and this is not what we're talking about regulating.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just a member, worried about what could happen in the future. I see two different references here, vehicle standards and then motor vehicle standards, and then the 169 code and many other statutes. As research could probably tell you, there's an assortment of definitions of what vehicles and motor vehicles are, and I don't even know what the technical definition, maybe they've got it for motor vehicle federally, and how that could change in the future. But I'm worried also, we've got ATVs a few years ago took over hundreds of thousands of them. They're surpassed snowmobiles now in registration. With that, the RVs, the ATVs, and the snowmobiles, it's a huge manufacturing operation that we'd have to be worried about if that definition did change. So I'd sure like to nail that down.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Dill.
I don't know if you'll know the answer to this. I'm certain someone in here does. My recollection is that California has standards that are quite strict on such as outboard motors that are substantially different than others states. And that's the reason I'm worried about this, is that or not worried, concerned about it, that we could be walking into, that there could be a pathway to get to these kind of standards unintentionally. You know, around here, unintended consequences are usually difficult to deal with. But I think that they have standards for outboards, because I recall that, just from recollection, that I see in the brochure something about outboards meet California emission standards. And so I'm kind of that time, I can see that, you know, you take one step, then the next step, and like I said, the camel, and I want to make sure I got the right end of that verse.
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, the regulations that we're talking about today pertain to passenger cars, light-duty trucks, and medium-duty vehicles. We're not talking about big commercial trucks, and we're not talking about those other types of vehicles, or outboard motors.
And Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Horton. Just in case this issue gets to be a big problem, which I don't really see it myself, but in case it does, it seems to me that we could also include language that says any time California would make a change, that this Minnesota law would be suspended until it's ratified by the legislature, which means that there would be a short period of time. I would assume California changes occur very seldom. There's not a lot of, you said in the past, how many, 20 for 40 years, or 50 changes? So on an annual basis or whatever, you might have a change? Or what, is there some way to provide a protection in there? It seems to me that that's what we're really concerned about, is that we're not getting a pig in a poke. In other words, think we're getting something and somebody else switches us into a category that could be very detrimental to Minnesota's economy and to our circumstances compared to California. And we may need a safety valve in there.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, Representative Osmond. Representative Horton, do you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, I would like to work with you on language that we could make clear the vehicles of the nature that we're talking about, aircraft and motor or boat motors and things like that, that if the California regulations should ever touch those entities, that we're no longer interested, and we opt back into the EPA program. But my understanding of the federal law is we go with the California Motor Vehicle Program or we go with the EPA. We can't, and I think it would be impractical for us to get together and ratify decisions made by this car board. I think they are made on a more frequent than annual basis, and some of them of a highly technical nature. So, but I would like to work with you on putting some language in there, some comfort language, some safety valve language regarding these other type of vehicles that are so important to our way of life here in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, to the point, and I'm when we're dealing with E85 in the state of Minnesota, it's extremely sensitive, and to think that they could somehow make a change in California, it could infect impact on our E85 vehicles in Minnesota. That's extremely disturbing. I think we need a safety valve. I agree with you on the other, the outboard motors, all the rest of it. I don't see it in here, but I do see E85 potentially getting impacted in an unintended consequence.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Osmond. Are there any other questions before we move on to the next testifier? Seeing none. Next one on the agenda, Eric Hyland. Mr. Hyland? Okay, they're all coming together. I guess we have a group coming together here. So, Mr. Hyland from Mizzarelli and Kramer, Mr. Greg Dana, the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers, and Mr. Jim Aylman from General Motors. If you'd like to introduce yourself before you speak.
We'll do that. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Eric Hyland from Ezra Lane Kramer, and I represent the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 car and light truck manufacturers, including BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi Motors, Porsche, Toyota, and Volkswagen. With me today is Greg Dana representing the Alliance and Jim Ellman from General Motors Corporation. Greg will talk about the general consequences of adopting the California standards, and then Jim will talk specifically about things we've already discussed here in terms of the interplay between the California standards and Minnesota's robust ethanol use, even after you've adopted the amendment that does not adopt the ZEB standard. There's still some ethanol concerns that I think is important for the committee to hear about. And so at this time, I turn it over to Greg Dana.
Welcome. Good evening. Excuse me. Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Greg Dana. I'm here on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Alliance strongly encourages you to oppose House File 863 calling for the implementation of the California's Low Emission Vehicle Program, or CALEV. The automobile industry shares the goals of HF 863, a clean environment, energy independence, and greatly reduced greenhouse gas emissions. Because of this commitment, we supported the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, or HR 6. And in fact, the Alliance's strong support in Congress for HR 6 was instrumental to its passage this past December. While we share the goals of HF 862, we disagree on the methods of achieving them. The Alliance supports an aggressive, comprehensive, and national approach to the climate change issues. We strongly encourage you to oppose HF 862, which virtually eliminates incentives for E85 vehicles, relinquishes Minnesota's authority to California, establishes a pathway of constantly changing regulations, and virtually ensures that valuable state resources will be siphoned away on far-reaching regulations, rather than being spent on more promising and beneficial technologies. The second piece of HR 6 is the requirement that automakers achieve an unprecedented 40% increase in corporate average fuel economy standards by 2020, resulting in a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions. This is far more than any other industry is being asked to reduce greenhouse gas emissions under any of the leading legislative proposals currently before Congress. In addition, HR 6 will reduce our nation's dependence on foreign oil and increase the production of clean and alternative fuels as well. By 2020, HR 6 is estimated to save 18 billion gallons of gasoline per year compared to projected consumption levels. It feeds equivalent to taking 30 million cars off the road. HR 6 also requires the United States to produce 21 billion gallons of advanced biofuels like cellulosic ethanol. However, making commitments and passing legislation was the easy part. The hard part is developing and integrating the technologies necessary to meet these commitments into vehicles that also meet consumer demands for safety, durability, capacity, payload, performance, and towing capability and price. In short, manufacturers must deliver vehicles consumers want at a price they can afford. Automakers are committed to doing just that, however, it is by no means an easy task. A legion of automotive engineers will work around the world and around the clock to innovate, integrate, test, and validate technologies and combination technologies in an attempt to satisfy the requirements HR 6 and vehicles consumers want and can afford. Our engineers have a lot of work ahead of them, and the patchwork of constantly changing state requirements only serves to complicate and distract the efforts that already show great promise for the future. The automotive industry has taken the lead in bringing innovative, clean, and efficient technologies to the market. Today, over 52 different models of alternative fuel vehicles, diesels, hybrids, ED5 capable, are available to consumers. Nearly 12 million of these vehicles on the road today, with almost 200,000 in Minnesota alone. The challenge the industry faces today is to improve on these technologies, develop missing pieces, and continue the innovation necessary to achieve the challenging 35 miles per gallon average we committed to in HR 6. The USCCA recognized the industry's commitment to meeting this aggressive goal by supporting the strong national program put in place by HR 6 and denying California's request to implement its own fuel economy regulations as part of the existing CALEV program. This action prohibits California and all the states from implementing CALEV's proposed fuel economy regulations. While this decision is being appealed, the current law does not allow for the implementation of California's proposed fuel economy regulations. In the wake of EPA's decision, Minnesota's plan to adopt CALEV as required in HF 863 would mean that the state is adopting only a smog and ozone-forming emissions program that provides no environmental benefit above and beyond the federal government's existing smog and ozone-forming program. In fact, the adoption of CALEV in Minnesota would be more problematic than it is beneficial. As we begin a discussion on the technical and policy implications associated with California's program, let's take a second to understand the three components of CALEV. The first component is the Low Emission Vehicle Program, or LEV-2, which regulates smog and ozone-forming compounds such as exhaust PM2.5, nitrogen oxides, organic compounds, carbon monoxide, and their toxins. The second component is zero emission vehicle mandate, which, if I understand the discussions earlier, is being taken out of the question here. So what you get if you adopt the bill today with the current denial of the waiver is simply a program to reduce smog and ozone-forming emissions, which is no different than the federal program by and large. In lieu of all the recent federal activity pertaining to both state and national fuel economy standards, the Alliance believes that implementing CalEV to H of 863 is the wrong public policy choice for the following reasons. Adoption of CalEV will not support the state's commitment to E85 technology and infrastructure. California standards may constrain the sale of E85 vehicles. Should the California Air Systems Board continue down their intended path and adopt an updated low-emission vehicle program in 2008, it's expected that the new emissions form will require the average vehicle to meet super ultra-low emission vehicles, I'm sorry, I didn't create that term, exhaust standards. Flexi-fuel vehicles cannot meet these standards. In addition, should the proposed fuel economy standards ever be implemented, there is no practical way for manufacturers to get credit for producing or selling E85 vehicles under the California program. And why is this? In order for manufacturers to get credit for their 85 vehicles, proof needs to be provided that the vehicles are operating 85 gasoline. An expert retained by California to testify on the issues of alternative fuels stated under oath that it would not be prudent for vehicle manufacturers to rely on the sale of 85 vehicles to generate sufficient credit to comply with the greenhouse gas standards proposed in the CalEV program. The California program will result in product restrictions. You may be asking why automakers believe HR 6 is better than California's proposed fuel economy standards. The answer is simple. California's program is too aggressive too soon for the time frame automakers need to design and launch our vehicles. The only cost-effective way to comply with California's program is to restrict the sale of specific vehicles. This means limited availability of the light trucks and SUVs that Minnesota's residents favor. Significant reductions in vehicle choice disproportionately impact Minnesota because of its unique market. Minnesota residents favor light trucks and SUVs with a sales mix of approximately 55% trucks and 45% passenger cars. In comparison, California, the state that designed and will retain control over the regulation, has a sales mix of approximately 49% trucks and 51% passenger cars. A national standard allows manufacturers to balance Minnesota's fleet, which leans toward trucks, against California's fleet, which leans toward cars. The California standards call for each state to conform to California's designated fuel economy averages. In order to comply in Minnesota, automakers will likely rely on product restrictions. This will severely limit the availability of light trucks and SUVs in Minnesota's favor. Minnesota should not cede its authority to California. CalEV is a California program designed by California legislators and regulators, none of whom are accountable to Minnesota or its residents. By adopting CalEV, Minnesota is ceding its authority to a state that is vastly different and tying itself to all future regulatory changes that California makes. Divergent market trends, economy drivers, and natural resources and air quality concerns separate Minnesota and California. Adoption of CalEV will lead to repercussions in not only the automobile industry, but in agricultural, tourism, forestry, construction, ethanol, and many other industries as well. H.R. 6 applies a high standard to all 50 states that is good for both consumers and energy security. Individually, state laws also have an important role to play in addressing transportation sector greenhouse gases. Among other initiatives, the Alliance believes that states can supplement the federal government's work by incentivizing the purchase and use of alternative fuel and advanced technology vehicles. Reaching a comprehensive goal requires a comprehensive approach. Not only should vehicles themselves be at the forefront of this discussion, the focus needs to be paid to the fuel powering these vehicles, as well as educating drivers regarding the green technologies available to them today and best practices in driving and maintaining their vehicles. States also have the opportunity to lead by example. When making fleet purchases, state and local governments should not only be considering advanced technology and alternative fuel vehicles, but they should be choosing the appropriately sized vehicle for the job as well. By making smart choices and showcasing their acceptance of green technologies, state and local governments can help build consumer acceptance of all of their fuel vehicles and enhance technology vehicles. Similarly, by investing in mass transit improvements and scrappage flow to get older, higher-emitting vehicles off the road, governments can show their commitment to a clean environment, energy independence, and greenhouse gas reduction. The agency spends billions of dollars annually, more than any other industry in the United States, on research and development on new and innovative technologies, but more needs to be done. Our engineers have been handed a very challenging mandate to achieve an average fuel economy average of 35 miles per gallon across all 50 states. We ask that you allow our experts to work toward achieving HR6's aggressive goal without being sidelined by the burden of complying with individual state programs designed to meet the same goal. Now I ask that you vote no on HF 863. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dana. And
I have a question. Let's
do Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dana, I think I heard you say that the way that California or Minnesota may achieve this is by changing the product mix. My recollection of the automobile industry is that the profit, real profit made by automobile dealers and by the manufacturers is in the high-end stuff like SUVs and pickups and things of that nature. And that would that be a fair assumption?
I believe that's true. I'm not a sales expert, but I believe that's true.
I've read that. So my question is if the product mix were to change to these more to the other vehicles, which would leave the smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles, wouldn't the company then have to make up that difference financially by raising the price of the smaller vehicles? Would that just seem logical?
Mr. Dana?
It's a difficult task to achieve what California wants. Let me try to explain this to you in as best English as I can. When Europe, Japan, and the United States have set fuel economy standards in the past, they've raised the standards by about 2% per year. And in NHTSA's view, the agency that sets the fuel economy standards, that's the maximum achievable level. H.R. 6, which just passed Congress and was signed by President Bush, the 35 miles per gallon by 2020, no one has set those regulations yet. But if we look at them and figure out what we have to do to meet those requirements, we think it's about a 4% per year. That's a tough task for the auto industry. If you look at what California does, and we say it's a much more aggressive standard, it increases the fuel economy by 13% in 1 year and 14.5% the next year. We don't have enough trained engineers or enough capital, financial capital, to redesign the entire fleet of cars and light trucks in the United States twice in 2 years. That's the problem with California. It sets a very aggressive set of standards much too quickly for us to comply with those standards. That's why they'll have to come for the product restriction.
Well, I don't know, Dale. Where I was trying to go with this a little is that if you're going to have to make all these technological changes to meet these requirements, and you don't make the money that you would normally make as you change the product mix, assuming you make the money on the SUVs, the biggest money on the SUVs and the light-duty trucks, and you need that money to try and implement the technology required, you must have to make that money then on the other products that are left that are sold, which are the other vehicles that you're changing to. And so what that my concern is that people who buy those vehicles are low and moderate income buyers already, and it'll make it that much more difficult and put an undue burden on the families that can least afford it, that are in the moderate to low income family brackets. So what we've done is we've kind of artificially made it more difficult for those kind of people to buy vehicles to achieve this goal. We've kind of shifted the cost burden, and it may be that the vehicles that gasoline would end up being cheaper through this mechanism in real terms, but when you can't afford to buy a vehicle, you can't afford to save the money on the gasoline. And I mean, I think there are people that go to the bank and can't get loans in the first place, let alone when the vehicle is more expensive. So that's kind of editorializing on my thought.
I can't think of pricing mechanisms that the manufacturers might use, because that's beyond my ability to do and acknowledge in the future. However, it will, if we have to restrict models, it will hurt the auto industry, and it will also hurt the auto dealers in the state in terms of the vehicles they can sell to the public.
that is the case. Mr. Dana, any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dana, I heard earlier that with the 12 states, whether they're including California or addition, that's about 40% of the U.S. population within those states. So
about right.
When you're talking about product restrictions, so let me just be clear on this. You just remove vehicles from 42% of the, as an option from 42% of the population? Is that what you're saying, or am I confused?
What I'm saying is that each manufacturer makes his own decision how he meets these requirements. But because the California standards are such an incredible jump year to year, it's likely that people restrict market availability, and it would be in 40% of the population of the country.
And then you discussed H.R. 6 in the past, I believe, was signed in December. How long had it been since the dealing with fuel efficiency standards had been modified? How many years had it been since it was last changed?
For passenger cars, it hasn't been changed since, I think, 85. For light trucks, it has been changed more recently. And, in fact, there are increasing fuel efficiency standards for light trucks going on today through 2011.
So 22 years for passenger cars that have been changed. And I guess my question is, what if H.R. 6 is not enough? What if what's happening with carbon emissions is not enough? What if we can't wait 22 more years before we address this again?
Mr. Dana? Well, I mean, we have standards now to be put in front of us through 2020. Obviously, if politicians somewhere in the United States decide they need to do more, they'll come and talk to us, I hope. But the standards that are in H.R. 6 are an extremely challenging set of standards for the auto industry to meet.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Mr. Jim Aleman from General Motors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am Jim Aleman, Manager of Vehicle Emissions at General Motors Public Policy Center. I am here today testifying on behalf of General Motors in opposition to House File 863 legislation that proposes to require adoption of the California Vehicle Emissions Standards. GM supports the comments made by the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, of which we are a member. I'd like to cover three items today to supplement the testimony of the Alliance. First, I will highlight GM's efforts to develop and bring to market advanced technologies to reduce emissions and improve fuel efficiency. And importantly, how these technologies are not limited to states with California requirements, but instead are being introduced nationally and even globally. Second, I will address how the California standards are an impediment to bringing forward one of these advanced technologies, E85 flex fuel vehicles. And third, I will discuss the problem with trying to implement the California standards in Minnesota, given that Minnesota consumers purchase a higher percentage of trucks than California consumers. Today's new vehicles, whether federally certified or California certified, are equipped with advanced catalytic converters that warm up in a matter of seconds, computers that precisely control the air-fuel ratio for optimum emissions performance, and onboard diagnostic systems that alert the driver to take the vehicle in for service if any of the emission systems are not functioning properly. These sophisticated technologies result in vehicles that are 99% cleaner for smog-forming emissions compared to pre-control vehicles. And as these newer, cleaner vehicles replace the older, higher-emitting vehicles in the on-road fleet, emissions will be reduced substantially by over 70% on a hydrocarbon plus NOx basis between the years 2000 and 2020. For improving fuel efficiency and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, GM is aggressively pursuing a broad array of technologies over the near, mid, and long term. For example, we continue to increase production of vehicles equipped with active fuel management, a technology that shuts off fuel to cylinders when full power from the engine is not needed. We have developed multiple hybrid systems, which we are deploying in a variety of models, ranging from mid-sized cars to SUVs and pickups to buses. The Saturn View Green Line, Saturn Aura Green Line, and Chevy Malibu are equipped with a GM hybrid system and are available today. The Chevy Tahoe and GMC Yukon full-size hybrid SUVs equipped with a two-mode hybrid system are coming early this year, and the two-mode system will be coming later this year to our Cadillac Escalade SUV and Chevy Silverado and GMC Sierra pickups. And we are developing a plug-in version of the two-mode hybrid system for application in our Saturn View. GM is developing multiple types of hybrid systems across a wide variety of products so that customers have a choice depending on their particular needs. GM also showed the Chevy Volt at the January 2007 Detroit Auto Show. The Chevy Volt is an extended range electric vehicle traveling 40 miles on a single charge of electricity from the battery. It is also equipped with a small internal combustion engine that kicks in only to provide energy to the battery to extend the range. We are aggressively developing this promising technology. We are also continuing our extensive efforts to develop fuel cell technology and will be placing over 100 Chevy Equinox fuel cell vehicles in service by the end of 2008. These vehicles will provide valuable customer feedback that will be used to help guide future fuel cell vehicle development. We are developing all of these technologies for national and global markets. These technologies are not being developed solely for states that have adopted California standards. We believe a national program is the best at ensuring national air quality goals are met, and that energy diversity through the use of alternative fuels is not impeded by policies that do not provide adequate flexibility for all technologies. That brings me to the technology that can do the most, in our opinion, to reduce petroleum usage and greenhouse gas emissions in the near term, which is flex fuel vehicles powered by E85 ethanol. GM has over 2.5 million E85 FFVs on U.S. roads today. We are building about 400,000 E85 FFVs annually, and we expect to double production by 2010. And by 2012, we have committed to half of our North American production being E85 FFVs. And we are actively working with businesses and governments in numerous states to get E85 refueling stations installed. This is an area that Minnesota has shown great leadership, with more than 300 stations installed in the state. And I might add that's far more than California, which has fewer than 10 stations. Fueling FFVs with E85 represents the best opportunity to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in the near term. Instead of gasoline, if an E85 is refueled with, or if an FFV is refueled with E85, with the ethanol being derived from corn, greenhouse gas emissions are reduced by about 20%. Refueling with E85 with the ethanol being derived from cellulosic sources reduces greenhouse gas emissions by over 60%. Unfortunately, the volume of E85 FFVs sold in states with California standards has been constrained in the past and continues to be constrained today. While emissions are generally reduced by refueling with E85 instead of gasoline, today's FFVs do not meet the California PSEV requirements, either the SULEV tailpipe standard or the zero evaporative emissions standard. The issue with meeting the SULEV tailpipe standard is controlling cold start NMOG emissions sufficiently to during those critical seconds after starting the engine to achieve the 0.01 grams per mile non-methane organic gas standard. And I might add here that the SULA standard is not only part of the zero emission vehicle mandate, but it's an integral part of the California LEV program and is something we need to certify to meet the fleet average NMOG emission requirements that's part of the LEV program. So eliminating the ZEV mandate does not resolve our concerns with E85 flex fuel vehicles. And then the other issue with the PZEV standard is the zero evaporative emission standard, which is not based on testing vehicles with E85 in them, which actually has lower emissions than testing with gasoline, but instead is because California requires FFEs to be tested on a worst-case blend of E10, or 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline. The situation will get worse going forward as FFE technology is rolled into more models, while the PZEV requirements and the SULEV requirements, which are part of the LEV program, continue to ramp up. And we expect further tightening of the requirements when California adopts its next round of emission standards, referred to as LEV3, which Minnesota would be bound to follow if it adopts California standards in order to maintain identical standards. Moreover, the California greenhouse gas requirements do not provide a practical incentive for E85 FFEs because manufacturers only get credit if they can track and report E85 usage for each individual vehicle. And I might add, the regulations appear to only allow for credit for E85 vehicles placed in fleet. And they also, unlike gasoline vehicles where they either don't add emissions for air conditioning or they give you a credit, they actually add air conditioning emissions for E85. And frankly, I'm not sure why they did that, but it seems unfavorable toward FFVs. I would now like to move to my third item, the problem with trying to implement the California standards in Minnesota, given that Minnesota consumers purchase a higher percentage of trucks than California consumers. Based on 2006 new vehicle registration, Minnesota's fleet was 56% light trucks as compared to California's 49%. This creates a problem due to the fact that California's program's requirements are based on state-specific sales. The state-specific sales include a sales-weighted fleet NMOG average, a sales-weighted CO2 fleet average, and the ZEV mandate. Using the ZEV mandate as an example, this requirement calls for at least 30% of a manufacturer's sales in the state to be PZEV or partial zero-emission vehicles. Most PZEV certified to date have been small or mid-sized cars, and those trucks that have been certified as PZEV have been smaller truck models. This is because smaller vehicles with their smaller engines are more capable of meeting the extremely low PZEV levels. Given that PZEVs are cars or smaller trucks, and these vehicles make up a significantly higher percentage of vehicles in California than in Minnesota, a manufacturer can achieve a 30% PZEV requirement in California, but may be well under the 30% level in Minnesota. A manufacturer could be forced to restrict the sale of trucks in Minnesota to attain the 30% level. And I understand the amendment to delete the ZEV mandate, but there would be similar problems and concerns with both the fleet NMOG average and the fleet CO2 requirements. In conclusion, I want to reiterate that GM supports the goals of Minnesota to reduce smog flaring emissions and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We disagree that the right approach for achieving these goals is by adopting the California program. GM supports a national program to address both vehicle emissions and fuel efficiency. We believe that petroleum-based fuels can no longer be the single source of energy for automobiles.
policies need to support alternative fuels and vehicles and not restrict their use. GM is working aggressively to become part of the solution with our many efforts on pushing advanced technology forward. But this must be combined with policies to help consumers adopt this technology and make alternative fuels available to consumers to enable them to utilize these fuels. This is an area in which Minnesota has led the nation, and we hope that they will continue to do so. That concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you. And Representative Dill? Representative Dill.
Thank you. To any of you, so if we adopt the standards, then that means that Minnesota cars are going to be more expensive because you had to... Would that be a fair assumption? Cars bought in Minnesota or sold in Minnesota would be more expensive.
Excuse me. Well, Mr. Ellman, or
as Greg Dana. Just let's talk about price in a trade association world. I mean, you can't talk about what pricing for future products might be. It's not something we can do.
Is there anybody in here that can address that?
Anyone? Okay. Seeing no one, any further questions? Yes. Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a Saturn, 1996 Saturn with 138,000 miles on it. Very pleased with it. And I would like to get a car that's built in America, designed in America, and made by a company in the United States that is the comparable size and has better mileage than I'm getting right now, and I can't find one after 12 years, and I'm frustrated about that. I could get another vehicle from that's not made here that does all those things, but I'm just saying that I'm trying to be open-minded and look at the facts as they're laid out, but at the same time, it comes at the end of a long string, two decades long string of reasons why we can't do stuff. And I heard the governor the other day in a state address, he said we're addicted to oil. I heard the president say we're addicted to oil, and I believe both of them, and I guess I would like to get serious. So if it is taking a while to ramp up to meet the California standards, I guess I'm frustrated that we haven't been able to get to that level now. That's my comment.
Okay. And do you want to respond or Representative Dill?
Yeah. I'll rephrase my question. Maybe it won't make any difference. Would it be fair to say then that a car purchased in Wisconsin or a neighboring state would be cheaper than a car that would be purchased in Minnesota? And I can't believe that anyone in this place that has a bill before the committee that has to do with automobiles isn't here to answer the question, are the cars going to be more expensive because this legislation does or doesn't pass? I mean, you got General Motors there before us. I haven't got an answer to that question. I can't believe there's no one in this room.
Representative,
can answer.
We have to build the vehicles today that have higher technology on them, more advanced materials, titanium, molybdenum, higher strength steel. That raises the cost of vehicles. We also meet customer demands for more safety on cars. Safety devices add weight, add cost per car. So we constantly see the average price of cars going up. That's likely to continue in the future as we design new technologies to try and meet HR6.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I think Mr. Lambert from the auto dealers will be able to speak a little bit more specifically about that.
And Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this chart we have about the various states that have adopted or proposed adopting the California standards, and you talked about the ratio of passenger cars to trucks, and there's two states on here that are indicated as having a higher ratio or higher percentage of trucks in their ratio than Minnesota, New Mexico and Oregon. They've both adopted the standards. Can any of you speak to whether they've had some of the problems that you're projecting in terms of choices and availability of vehicles?
Their programs haven't really started yet. Okay. Oregon starts in 2009 and New Mexico in 2011.
Okay.
But understand that, Dana, for us as the auto manufacturers, it's much easier to average across the entire nation in meeting an average standard. having to meet an average daily in any every given state separately is a very difficult task because the fleet mix is different in every state. So for us, the national program is the best possible solution.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand why, from the manufacturer's point of view, you prefer a national standard, but I also understand that we are state policymakers and our ability to influence policy is at this level, and we are trying to move the national discussion, but the only way, the best way we are capable of moving the national discussion is at the state level. So there's, you know, different angles on this issue.
Representative Hackbarth.
I'll
pass. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess this is for any one of the three of you. Are you telling me that there's a scenario, I think its effective date is 2012, that we could have somebody, say he's a landscape contractor that wants to buy a new pickup, he might actually not be able to buy a pickup? He wants to spend the money, maybe we'll be in a recession in 2012, and we want to promote somebody buying a new pickup in Hastings. Are you telling me that they may not be able to buy it in Hastings, but potentially they could buy it in Prescott, Wisconsin? So if the landscaper was out of Prescott, Wisconsin, he might be able to buy a pickup? And the landscaper in Hastings might... There's no way. You aren't saying that are you?
Those are two very different questions. I'll try to answer both of them. It's possible that we may have to restrict sales of larger, heavier vehicles to meet California requirements. Again, I can't project future what a manufacturer will do, but it's very possible that could take place. However, under California's rules, you cannot go to an adjoining state and bring a vehicle back into the state. California adopted what they call a 7,500-mile new car rule to prevent people from going to Nevada and buying a new car and bringing it back into Nevada, which didn't meet California standards. So unless you want to go into Wisconsin and drive for 7,500 miles before you bring it back in the state, it'll still be considered a new car.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. You just answered it in the worst way you could. So we're actually going to make the landscaper move from Hastings to Prescott because he can't buy the pickup from Prescott, but he can go live there. And then he can his residency can be there, and he can pay their lower state tax than our state tax. What are the other incentives? Lower work comp rate, and they want to be, but he can do his work in Hastings still. So if he wants to buy F-350 or a 3500 Silverado, one of the heavy pickups, and put a plow on it and stuff, you're saying there's a possible scenario because of our mix of vehicles being different than California, and we have substantially more trucks because we work and enjoy the outdoors and stuff, but there's a scenario that we could be an island in the group of states here. And you know, I understand they can't go buy the new truck. Maybe they'll have to wait till it's a day old in Prescott or go buy it and move to Prescott or whatever they want to do. Those are the scenarios that you're laying out for us?
Actually, I haven't heard that one before, but that's a possible scenario that he might move to Wisconsin and still be business in this state.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been competing with those people for 30 years, so it's real.
Mr. Chair. Representative Dale.
Well, now you piqued my interest on another idea. You talk about eliminating the heavier trucks. Well, what makes those trucks so heavy? The materials they're made out of?
Mr. Dana?
Trucks are designed to carry a load, to tow a boat, to do other things.
And what are they made out of?
They generally have heavier springs to tow heavier loads.
What are the springs made out of?
Iron steel.
Oh, boy, that'll be something the Iron Range delegation will be glad to vote for, is to sell less steel. That let's see, how many votes is that in the House? I mean, that's four votes there for that, I'm sure.
Any other questions? I would say the thing to ask, it seems to me that during certain periods of American history, the automobile industry has been very innovative. And industry generally in America, during times of war, for instance, when we've needed to retool, during World War II, when we had to retool, there were some drastic changes that needed to be made, and they were made very quickly, went from making cars into making trucks and tanks and military equipment, weapons. It seems that the innovation was incredible, and the speed at which industry in this country could move was incredible. And I'm wondering, one of the things you're saying is that our industry has lost its ability to change that quickly and to meet crisis on a moment's notice in situations.
I think in the last 5 years, we've started developing plug-in hybrids. We're bringing advanced technology diesels into this country for the first time in the light-duty market. Well, it's the first time, it's the second time. The first time was a disaster. We've got a lot of different technologies we're developing right now, today, and they're being implemented today in the next 5 years or so. So I disagree with you. We spend more money than any other industry in this country on research and development. We pioneer a lot of what technology is developed in this country, and we're doing that every year.
Well, I just brought it up because I feel that some of the standards being set here seem relatively modest when you compare it with some of the changes that needed to occur during times of war. And maybe sometimes it takes a crisis to push the changes that you saw during those periods. But it seems that what you're saying is that there are some real obstacles to innovation that are moving that quickly. If you need years in order to implement changes. But it seems to me that there's a lot of the technologies available today. You know, I even see some of the vehicles that are out there today. You do have, pickups that are compliant with E85 that you can use today. And I understand there's some differences as far as whether this would encourage E85, which I think it does have the potential to, because you could get credit for E85 vehicles. And they're out there, and the technologies seem to be there. There seems to be, there's a need to pull it all together, though. And so are the obstacles more technological, or are they more bureaucratic?
We've already implemented many, many new technologies in cars today, like four-valve engine heads. We've got mostly what they call, different manufacturers call different things, where you displace cylinders, turn them off, and engine them under heavy load. We've got hybrids, working on plug-in hybrids. Technology is all over the place now in the United States today. But the types of things I was trying to explain to you, what California does, is it jumps too quickly to where we don't have the resources to make those changes fast.
It sounds to me like it's more bureaucratic almost, that the technologies are
well,
there.
Let me make an additional comment too, if I could. When we come out with start working on a new technology, we go through what I call generations of design. So our first generation of design will be relatively expensive, and we frankly can't afford to put it out in the market in high volume. But we'll have our engineers keep working in the laboratory on the development and come out with a second and third and fourth generation of design. But that takes time and resources. But as we go along with each generation of design, we are able to increase the volume because the cost is coming down. But it's just that kind of process that we need to go through.
And any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just want to reiterate one point that Mr. Ellman brought up, and that is I know there's a great deal of concern about the interplay between these regulations and the use of ethanol in the state, and Minnesota has been a leader in this area. And so I would caution folks to accept the fact that California has grasped the use of ethanol in an equally robust way, because as Mr. Ellman made reference to, according to the National Ethanol Vehicle Coalition website, as of the first of the year, there were precisely 3 retail E85 pumps in the entire state of California. And so while everybody is up here talking about how E85 can be used and met to reach these standards in California, it's a little difficult to me to understand how that's capable if you only have 3 E85 pumps.
As I understand it, however, it wouldn't be applied exactly the same in Minnesota as it is in California, because it is based on the fleet and the fleet mix. So, and it's also based on the number of E85 pumps, which we have more up here in Minnesota. So.
Yeah. My only point was the contrast of how California has treated the whole issue of ethanol versus what Minnesota has to do.
Thank you, Mr. Highland. And any other questions before we move on? Okay, seeing none, we will then move on to the next testifier, Mr. Scott Lambert.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Scott Lambert. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. You would normally see my colleague, Alyssa Schlander, here today, but after having the pleasure of serving on the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group for the last 8 months, I anticipated there might be some questions about that, so I'm going to take the lead today, but should of course speak for us on all other matters at all other times. Let me, because we talked a little bit about it, and I did serve on that with my friend Jim Urkel on the advisory group, and I just want to clarify how this came out of that group. There were basically, Mr. Thornton's off to the side here, he can verify this if I'm right or wrong. There were three baskets of options. Basically, everything was recommended. It's fair to say that everything was recommended, but there was the complete consensus basket, which is where things went into with that, that there was no objections to. There were some other recommendations that came out of the advisory group that were had some objections, some questions to, but not enough to disrupt the majority opinion, of course. So they went into the second basket, and then there were sort of the controversial baskets, things that did not attain the supermajority that the other two went into. This proposal is in that third, more controversial basket. So it's not quite fair to say that it received a unanimous approval, but it was recommended, but with a lot of caveats to it and with some consideration. Mr. Chairman and members, we represent the retailers in this debate, and we feel that us, like the consumers, are caught in the middle of this debate between the environmental community that wants to impose a large change on our market and the manufacturers who say that the change can't be achieved. Now, for those of you who are kind of relatively new to the process, we haven't had a big fight in a lot of years, but it's kind of unique for us to be on the same side of the table as the manufacturers. And in fact, if Representative Portman has achieved nothing else, she's got us working together for one. So that's we appreciate that. Thank you. But we normally spend a lot of our time kind of working against the manufacturers and protecting the dealers from the manufacturers through our franchise law and such. But this is a big issue. And all that being said, our industry is very concerned about the ramifications of Representative Portman's proposal and the California Car Emissions Initiative. For us, it's simply a matter of inventory. We want to make sure that consumers have the ability to purchase the vehicles they want. The California standards simply move too far too fast. It's a matter of mathematics. The only way the manufacturers can achieve these aggressive standards is to remove trucks, minivans, and SUVs off showroom floors. While that may be the goal of some of the groups in this fight, it'd be devastating to our $11 billion industry. We are right now 20% of the retail economy in this state, although I will say we are in a bit of a recession right now. We have 20,000 employees who are going to suffer through this, and I think the Minnesota economy as a whole is going to take a beating. The new California standards demand a 13 to 14% increase per year for 7 years. That's in comparison to the 35 mile per gallon federal initiative just passed in December, which calls for an aggressive but we hope achievable 4% standard per year, 4% increase per year. The new federal standards push the industry. The California standards push the industry over a cliff, and we are very concerned about that. This is not California. California sells more cars than trucks. Minnesota sells more trucks than cars. We're different from California. We have an economy based on agriculture, on tourism, on forestry, on mining. It's colder here. There's just simply a lot of changes, a lot of differences between us and California. If Ford stops giving F-150s to a dealer because too many F-150s push them over the standards in Wilmer and Fergus Falls and Grand Rapids, you can only sell so many Focuses. You know, the trucks are the market there. Not as big a deal in the Twin Cities, but it's a very big deal to our members. We have 454 members in this state. 70% of them are in small family dealerships in outstate Minnesota. And they're the ones who are going to take this on the chin. And we are very concerned about it. Mr. Chairman, Congress acted to impose aggressive new standards, which dealerships supported, last December, and we should let those standards work. We have a few other concerns about Representative Hortman's bill. Some of them have already been expressed here. Number one, Minnesota be abdicating its authority to the California Resources Board, an unelected bureaucracy that oversees their quality for a much different economy than Minnesota's. The imposition of law would actually, we believe, have an opposite effect over time, as people would hang on to their trucks longer because newer vehicles would be more difficult and more expensive to get. And frankly, the best way to clean the air and to lower CO2 is to turn the fleet over, to get older cars off the road. It would mean a reversal of the state's ethanol policy, but we've already chatted about that, and I'm sure we'll be chatting about that again in future committees. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make one mention. Mr. Urkel passed out this list, and he talked about how this is gathering steam and working in other states. I just 5 days ago came from a meeting of all my colleagues from around the country, and I will have to disagree a bit that there's a lot of momentum for this. I think in about half a dozen of these states, these bills are stalled, and they're stalled for the same reason that I'm expressing here, because the standards are simply too aggressive. They move too far, too fast, and can't be absorbed by their local retail climate. Mr. Chairman, we did put up the website DontTakeMyTruck.com. After 8 months of sitting on the governor's climate change advisory group, I am very concerned that there is an element within the environmental community that wants to take people out of trucks. They will regulate them out of trucks. They will tax them out of trucks. People don't drive minivans and SUVs because they always want to. They drive them because they have to. It's a part of their job. It's a part of their lifestyle. People still buy cars. The number one reason people buy cars is for safety. And for whatever their reason, it's a choice they feel they need to make. And it has been described to me by several environmentalists that we should all just be driving one car. Wouldn't it be easier if we just had one car? And that sort of talk bothers us a lot and scares me. We want to make sure that inventory and consumer choice is available to consumers. So we are concerned about the attitude toward trucks, and we are concerned about this bill taking away those choices. Let me anticipate Representative Bill's question about price.
I got another.
Well, let me take care of this one, sir, if I could. I can't speak to what it's going to cost the manufacturers to build a car or a truck. That's their business. But if you're if you've got a dealership, in, a Ford dealership, let's say in Eveleth, that works, and you normally sell 12 pickups a week, and now suddenly because the standards are changed, and they can only, you're only really going to get from the manufacturers two or three pickups a week, there's just not enough market for the Focuses and the Tauruses. People want trucks. Those trucks are now going to be in demand. They're going to be hard to get, and the dealer is going to have to pay for the inventory of the other cars that he can't sell. It's just reasonable to expect that he's going to sell those cars off at a higher price, and it's not gouging, but it is in fact just the simple laws of supply and demand. I think that'll take trucks as they become scarcer, as what 55-56% of this market wants. As those become scarcer, they're going to become more expensive. So I think that's the answer to your question. Mr. Chairman, we just, in general, we think that this proposal is a dramatic overreach by the environmental community, and I think it will have a devastating effect on our industry, and I think on the Minnesota economy as a whole. And I thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. And Representative Dell has another question.
Well, Mr. Lambert, did I hear you say right? You said trucks, SUVs, and minivans?
Yes, sir. Minivans are part of this mix.
Well, you know, I thought when I heard this bill that this was about taking the ice cream off of the pie a la mode. But my God, now you're cutting, this bill cuts into the apple pie. America. I mean, I'd hate to go outside and look in the parking lot and see how many minivans there are out there. And how many soccer moms are going to come unglued because they can't have their minivan, if that's what you're telling me. I mean, maybe I'm
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the numbers, but I've always been told that we are one of the largest minivan markets in the country, and this will affect minivans and SUVs.
Well, I got a minivan at E85. I'm not giving it up.
I mean, that's getting a little out of control here.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lambert, are you saying that we can't have less emitting trucks or minivans or more, and I want to be clear, there's two differences here, more fuel efficient and or less emitting. Are you saying we can't do that with trucks and that the people who are coming into your members' businesses aren't asking for less emitting or more fuel efficient trucks?
No, sir. I'm not. I'm sorry if I led you to believe that, but no, I'm not saying that at all. I think we can have more efficient vehicles across the board, including trucks.
So what you're saying is you can meet the federal standard, but you can't meet the California standard to have more or less emitting trucks and minivans.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, we can. We believe the industry can meet the federal standards at 4% a year to 2020, to the combined fleet average of 35 miles per gallon. We do not believe that we can achieve the California standards without removing product off the showroom floor.
Representative Hansen.
And are your members seeing any consumer demand for less emitting beyond that? I mean, do you have people come in and say, I'd really like to get it, like Representative Gardner said, I'd want less emitting or a more fuel efficient truck or minivan? You know, they may not know what happened in December or what's right. going to be happening, but what demand are you seeing from consumers? I mean, I drive a truck. It's a 2000 truck. I wish it could be more fuel efficient and less emitting. I don't have the same money as Representative.
Why, I pay for Canadian money.
So I'm trying to gauge what your members are hearing from consumers, because it would seem to me that people would be wanting the manufacturers to be aggressive as we could be in the country, to provide those choices for consumers.
Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I believe what you said is correct, that consumers do want, there's a growing demand for hybrid vehicles. There's a growing demand for more fuel-efficient vehicles. Still, everything I see as an industry rep is that when people, the number one reason people look for when they purchase a vehicle is safety, and it's still the number one reason. The other areas are growing, and I think that's a reflection of the times, of people's consciousness of environmental issues and of gas prices. Okay.
And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for bringing up gas prices. When I hear folks talk about anything about cars, they said, have you been to the gas pump lately? Have you paid the price to fill up your car, truck, whatever? It's enormous. You're telling us on one hand that you want to give consumers the vehicles they want, but what consumers are asking for right now is better gas mileage. They don't want to pay so much at the pump. And so it's really disappointing to hear that you're not going to meet that consumer concern, because you're arguing that the industry is incapable of good engineering. It's disappointing that we can't be as good as Europe and Asia. That's scary.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I'll just restate that Minnesotans buy more trucks than cars. Trucks is what they want.
Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I heard you say that the number one reason that people buy a vehicle is because of safety. And I happen to drive a General Motors car. I love my car. But I've been waiting for, actually when I bought it, I wanted to buy a Honda Accord because it got such better gas mileage. But I couldn't get one because everyone wanted those. And so I'm thinking, well, I'll just wait a little while and maybe General Motors will produce something that's sort of like that. But they didn't. I'm still waiting because I do like my car. But if you say the number one reason is safety, are you saying that your small cars aren't safe?
No. Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad I have a chance to clarify that. No, our small cars are very safe. It's safety can mean a lot of different things. If you wouldn't want to safely try and haul your camper with your Ford Focus. Maybe that's a better way to say it. You've got to be able to have the towing. You have to be able to have the car that can do what you demand of it to do, and that's a safety issue. So no, our small cars are very safe. I hope we can get you into a new one very soon.
And Representative Dill?
Sure. Thank you. Maybe, Mr. Lambert, you can answer this. Earlier, Mr. Dana, I think it was, said that with California had a neighboring state regulation where you couldn't buy a car. It was in reference to Representative McNamara's question and bring it into Minnesota. How about a foreign country? How about an Indian reservation, or how about if an Indian reservation had a Ford dealership or a GM or whatever dealership on the reservation? That's a sovereign nation. And also, I was wondering about Canada, because I'm thinking about Worley Motors up in International Falls, and if the price of their pickup trucks, and I can guarantee you in International Falls, the pickup trucks are a lot more popular than Focuses. And if Worley Motors had to raise their price on pickups, well, why wouldn't they go across to over to Causeway Motors and buy the vehicle over in Canada if it was substantially cheaper? I'm thinking about border problems that this bill might create.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, that's a good question. I'm not sure I'm 100% on it. My understanding of the California regulations are that you just simply cannot import those vehicles. I don't really know the answer to the Indian question. Or a foreign country like Canada. I don't think you can, but I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. I think that's correct.
Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lampert, you used a number of, and I believe the trio of previous testifiers used a number of Minnesota has 56% trucks, and the number we have is 46%. But I believe that you maybe were using a different year. If I remember right, don't we continue to go in Minnesota more trucks, less cars each year? Is that a true analogy? Is that the way Minnesota's been moving?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I think that's correct. And I would be happy at the next stop to flesh that out. But based on the retail numbers that we track, it's always gone more trucks than cars and trends that way.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to the next testifier, Mr. Richard Ryan. Thank you, Mr. Ryan, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Ryan. I'm a business representative for Twin Cities Automotive Lodge, 737 in the Twin City area here. Came before the committee today to express our opposition to this bill. I represent approximately 700 machinist union members under contract with the St. Paul Automobile Dealers Association, including service technicians, body personnel, parts and support staff. Their livelihood depends on the ability of the dealerships they work for to remain competitive and profitable. In addition, the machinist union also represents auto dealers employees in Cloquet, International Falls, and the St. Cloud area. The Teamsters Union represents auto dealer employees in the Minneapolis area, and the UAW represents auto dealers employees in Duluth. As you may or may not be aware, franchise auto dealers are going through difficult times right now with the slowdown in the economy, especially the domestic brands where the majority of our employees members work. Since our last contract was ratified on April 30th, 2006, we've had 3 out of the 30 dealerships that have closed, not sold, but closed in our area. That's 10% of our stores have closed, have lost quite a few members as a result of that. In the previous 3 years, we had 4 additional stores closed. Those jobs are gone. A few of those people were able to find positions at other stores, but many were not. Many other franchises are currently faced with pressure from the factories for mergers and consolidations. And a number we've had, in addition, we've had a number of our members laid off recently due to work slowdown. We feel that placing any additional burden on franchise auto dealers will severely affect our members. We do understand the authors the desire to see reductions in greenhouse gases and automobile emissions in Minnesota. However, we don't want the dealership that we work for to provide the livelihood for our families to be put at any kind of competitive disadvantage. We respectfully would suggest that a better alternative might be to provide some kind of tax credit or rebate to encourage purchase of higher mileage, lower emissions cars, minivans, trucks, and SUVs. Not only would this encourage people to drive greener vehicles, but it would also serve to boost sales at our dealerships and stimulate the local economy. We believe a carrot approach is of encouraging the switch to greener cars is preferable to the stick approach of adopting the emissions and fuel economy standards that are set in California. That concludes my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And are there any questions for Mr. Ryan? Okay, seeing no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. And Representative Portman, would like to make any final statements here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know everybody's probably anxious to get to their Valentine's dates if they have them, but I just had a few brief comments to make in response to the testimony that has been provided. I think it's just very important to be clear on this E85 issue, that not only is it in good shape under the standard, but E85 vehicles get extra credit under the standard. They get a 26% bonus of carbon emissions, even more than what they reduce it by just running E85 alone. So in the California Attorney General's office prepared a fact sheet on that November 9th, but I'm not sure if you want one more sheet of paper on your sheet or on your desk. Representative Gill brought up the point of supply and demand and the issue of gas prices, and actually there is data from the federal government that shows if California's greenhouse gas emission reduction program goes into effect in California, they estimate that the price of gas will drop 6 cents a gallon in that region due to decreased demand for gasoline. The same impact will happen in supply and demand and the supply of diesel trucks and flex fuel vehicles, because diesel trucks are your bigger trucks that guys would like to have for their mining and their lumber-type occupations would become cheaper, because they would be a way for manufacturers to meet the standard more quickly. Diesel is a much more efficient fuel. I passed out information about diesel before. If your landscaper in Prescott, Wisconsin is okay with a diesel truck, or your landscaper in Hastings is okay with diesel or E85, there'd be no reason to go buy a truck in Prescott, Wisconsin. And I think that the reason why Mr. Ryan's union brothers and sisters are having a hard time keeping their jobs in this industry is that the automakers here aren't making the cars we want to buy. There's waiting lists for Priuses. There's waiting lists for some other very fuel-efficient cars. I sure wish that that Ford plant across the river, or maybe we're on the same side of the river, on this side of the river, were making something like a Prius instead of the Ford Ranger truck. And maybe due to the standard, Ford Ranger truck actually might see a longer life. But finally, I would just say in closing to Representative Osmond that I'd be happy to work with you on safety valve language, so that if there's some way that we can, without screwing up the choice that the federal government has set up for us of California or EPA, if there's some way that we can have some oversight before automatically accepting something that California does, I'd be happy to add that into the bill. So I'd hope that you'd be willing to work with me on that. And then my final comment would be, in 1970, when Congress was considering the Clean Air Act, Lee Iacocca went and testified before Congress. And he said, he was executive vice president of Ford at the time, he said this Clean Air Act could stop production of the automobile by 1975, and it was a threat to the entire American economy and to every person in America. And I I don't believe that our auto manufacturers will have any trouble in meeting the standard because of the innovation that Representative Eakin referred to during World War II. We know that we can move fast, and we know we can do a lot in this economy, and I believe this bill will actually create jobs.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. And any questions for Representative Hortman before we move on? Representative Osmond?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hortman. I really appreciate the willingness to try and work on this. I have to tell you, I'm in a very uncomfortable zone right now. As I've been listening to how this is put together and realizing it's more like a state compact. It's, like where we have, and we've got a real process in place in order to establish compacts, where not only all the different legislatures have to sign off on it, but then it has to go to the federal government and get signed off on, and it was quite the process. And stuff that we've been able to work through on that issue, or that type of an issue, has taken us a long time. And to have one hearing here right now, I'm very concerned about the protection of some changes that could occur by California that could negatively impact Minnesota without us having an alternative. I'm also concerned that there's, with regard to the comments on flex fuel, I need to do more study on that. Would encourage you to work a little more on this legislation before the policy committee actually votes on it. Is your intent to take a vote on this, Mr. Chair?
The intent is to take the vote on it. It's got several stops to make yet before, and with the aggressive timelines, we wanted to move forward. So,
unfortunately, I like the concept, but I'm also a strong believer that the committee shouldn't be passing on work that's not complete enough to where we can say to the next committee, we really want to recommend your support, and I'm not there yet.
Okay. Well, it oftentimes happens where members agree to work on things in the interim between the voting out of one committee and going into the next. So I appreciate your suggestion, Representative Osmond, and it sounds as Representative Hortman is very willing to work with you on some of your concerns there. So any other comments? For questions before we move on. Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, did you say in your motion where you're sending it to? What is the next stop?
The next stop would be government operations.
Okay.
Yes.
And do we know, is it going to commerce? What other stops might it be made?
Commerce is one that... Commerce is one that it would be going to as well.
All right.
Yes, I believe so. That's very important, if you can address that.
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Atkins has asked to see the bill and that it will be going to Commerce.
Okay.
I also believe it's going to Environmental Finance to deal with any fiscal note issues we might have.
Okay.
But I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. And any other comments? I think Representative McNamara, did you have an amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe I can just spend a couple of minutes to run through what my amendment is and what some of my concerns are.
And if you would move the amendment.
If I could move, Mr. Chair, it's the A1 amendment, and it's had a couple of markups because it's drafted. Oh, I apologize. The author doesn't have it.
Okay. Representative McNamara moves the A1 amendment. Representative McNamara.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically what this is, Representative Hortman, I agree with you. I think this has got some real potential. My concern is the one I laid out, that we're creating ourselves to be an island in an area where we won't be competitive with our adjoining states. And all I'm saying in this amendment is that we'll adopt it. All the language is there, and it'll take effect when our adjoining states adopt the same language. So we won't have a scenario of where we have people literally moving potentially out of the state or looking at ways to buy a vehicle that's a day old and it's now become a used vehicle and they can buy that. I want us to be competitive. I want us to be nation leading. I'm concerned. Our vehicle mix is completely different than California. They drive a substantially different mix with more cars, less trucks. I think some of this needs to be fleshed out. So members, this is a good amendment. This says we'll do the bill. The adjoining states need to act on it. When the adjoining states act on it, it takes effect for us. And so I'm certainly hopeful that Representative Hortman will really like this amendment.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, I hate when those cheeseheads do anything before we do. And they already have better roads. I'm not going to wait until they decide to be active on motor vehicle emissions until Minnesota decides whether or not to take a leadership role. So I would recommend that members vote against the amendment.
Do you have any other comments or questions on the amendment? All right, seeing none.
Chair, this is just an amendment. I would ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been called. Okay, no other comments or questions? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Eakin?
No.
Brenner?
No.
Cornish?
Aye.
Dill?
Yep.
Gardner?
No.
Heckler?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Hoppy? Mariani?
No.
McNamara?
Aye.
Moe?
No.
Olin?
Aye.
Osmond?
Yes.
Saylor?
No.
Scalzi?
No.
Tell?
No.
Tinglestead?
Aye.
Lagunia?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, yes, Representative Heckler.
I'd like a roll call vote on the bill, and I want people to know who's going to be voting for this and who's going to be voting against it and who's going to be allowing consumers to go and buy a new pickup truck, a new F-350, for example, in 2012. I think people need to know who those people are that are going to refuse them that opportunity.
Okay. Roll call has been called for.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Mariani.
Sure, I want to thank Representative Hackler for the ability to make a roll call so that people know that I care deeply about CO2 emissions in our society.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, Representative Scalzi, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Scalzi renews the motion that House File 863 has amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. And the clerk will take the roll.
Eakin?
Yes.
Reiner?
Yes.
Cornish?
Nope.
Bill?
Nope.
Gardner?
Yes.
Heckler?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hoppy? Mariani?
Yes.
McNamara?
No.
Moe?
Yes.
Olin?
No.
Osmond?
No.
Saylor? Scalzi?
Yes.
Hell?
Yes.
Tinglestead?
No.
Lagunia?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed as amended. So, thank you, Representative Hortman, and we'll meet again on Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.